thank you so much for your goodness and kindness to us. Thank you that we're beginning a year where we have 52 times this year, amazing gift, 52 times to be together and to hear you speak to us through the Bible and be changed by your Spirit. And I pray now that your word would do your work, that each and every one of us, whether we'd identify as a Christian or aren't quite there yet, would meet Jesus as he walks off the pages of the Bible. And I ask and pray that in Jesus' name. And all God's people said, Amen. Please do take a seat. Let me be the 18th person to say Happy New Year. Up on the screen, there'll appear a picture of this wonderful lady. This lady's called Helen, and she became a Christian. All being a Christian means is to trust your life with Jesus. She became a Christian back in October, not least actually through some very good friends who she'd known for decades who knew Jesus and were open just to talk about their life experience of Jesus. And over Christmas, she wrote me a letter, sent me a message, and this is what she said. As I listened to the Bible and heard it taught, that's what we're doing this morning, isn't it? Listening to the Bible and hearing it taught. So I wonder what you're expecting that's going to do. She said, as I listened to the Bible and heard it taught, it was like an 1,000-watt light bulb. I started to see clearly. I understood all sorts of things about my life, myself. But most of all, I saw Jesus. He was just lovely to see and strong, stronger and strong enough, beautiful and strong and real. Isn't that fantastic, isn't it? As the Bible is read and taught, I'm fully persuaded that Jesus walks right off the pages. And many of us this morning, we're going to identify as Christians. We would have done this many, many times. Well, right at the beginning of 2024, it's brilliant to remind ourselves what we're doing, isn't it? That Jesus walks off the pages of the Bible and meets you. Lots of us this morning are not going to be Christians, not yet anyway. There could be all sorts of reasons we're here this morning. And I think what Helen says there is brilliant. It's a brilliant reminder that being a Christian is not about following some kind of set of religious rules or some moral regulations that you have to meet the standard of or attending some particular rituals. It's about a relationship with God himself in Jesus, who is strong, strong enough, and beautiful. What a fantastic invitation this morning, as we hear the Bible taught, to meet Jesus for the very first time. I really want to offer that out to you. Don't think for a moment being a Christian is about going to church, giving your money, or as someone once said to me, I'm a good Christian because I give blood. Not quite sure how that works. It's not about rules or regulations or particular rituals. It is entirely about a beautiful and wonderful relationship with a real person called Jesus, who in Helen's words is beautiful, strong, and real. And I think the last thing I'd like to borrow from Helen and just reflect with you before we get going into Nehemiah is, without doubt this morning, or listening online, having a little kind of look in through the window of what church might be like, there's some of us here because it is the first Sunday of the new year. You made some resolutions, and you've turned over a new leaf, including your spiritual health, and you're going to come to church. Well, I just want to say to you, Jesus is delighted that you are here this morning. He doesn't just offer you a new leaf, he offers you a new life. And that is a fantastic gift that you could receive this morning. So that's what's going to happen as for 52 times this year, we're going to listen to the Bible and hear it taught. It's going to be like an 1,000-watt light bulb. So I'd love for you to open up Nehemiah. If you grab one of the kind of maroony, reddy, purple Bibles that are scattered around the church, you'll find that on page 485, page 485. Or please be unashamed to get out your phone and just Google it, Nehemiah chapter 1, and particularly do that if English isn't your comfortable language. Why don't you find it on your phone in a language that is your heart and mind thinking? Nehemiah chapter 1. See, Nehemiah, this book, is the very last piece of Old Testament history, closing thousands of years of attempts by Israel in the Old Testament to form an independent and self-governing nation. And yet each one of those attempts leading up to Nehemiah has failed, either because of disappointing leadership or internal dispute or civil war that ripped Israel apart, or because they were invaded or assimilated. And more recently in Israel's history, Babylon had invaded. And Babylon's strategy was to disperse a conquered population right the way across their empire, confiscate all of their national wealth, and therefore ruin any opportunity for collective rebellion. And Babylon had come along, scooped up Israel and a whole bunch of other neighboring nations, and dispersed their people across the Babylonian empire. And then most recently in the story, Persia had come along, because there is always a bigger fish in the pond. And Persia had come along, and Persia had invaded Babylon. And Persian strategy was a little bit different. They returned conquered people back to their homeland. They gave them back their confiscated wealth. They invited them to reestablish as a federation of nations, and then they taxed them really highly. And so Persia had begun to dismantle the Babylonian Empire and sponsor the return of all these conquered people, including Israel. And Ezra, who writes the book just before Nehemiah, Ezra had led two waves of returning people back to a place called Judah, where they'd come from. But then what had happened is some of the surrounding nations, as Ezra is leading the people back and trying to rebuild the city, some of the surrounding nations had remembered the historical antagonism between Israel and them. And they had petitioned the Persian government to halt Israel's return. And the Persian king had appeased that request and withdrawn the support he'd given to Ezra. And so Ezra's return was halted, with only a few of the people returned, with the reconstruction of the city and the nation half-hearted and half-done, and no real wealth to establish them. And so when we get to this point in Nehemiah, there are, in essence, two distinct groups of believers. First of all, there's folk like Nehemiah, who remained in the Babylonian Empire, dispersed and hidden and quiet, their faith silent, so they could live a peaceable life. Do you see Nehemiah in chapter 1, verse 1? Have a look with me. It says, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, while I resided in the capital city of Babylon. So the reality is, these are folk, believers, who live assimilated, hidden, quiet, submerged, silent, safe, and comfortable lives, where no one around them really knows about their love and delight in God. Now, I think there are some very appropriate times to be discreet about our faith. Hannah and I observed last year as Salome helped two young Chinese students become Christians for the very first time. Over a 5, 6, 8 month journey, week by week, she led them through Mark's account of Jesus' life, and they decided to trust Jesus with their life. But both those young women went back to hostile homes in hostile nations. There's a wisdom in discretion there, isn't there? But I think what we need to learn from Nehemiah is, for most of us living our faith, if we trust in Jesus, it is not appropriate for it to be a silent, hidden, or quiet faith. Nehemiah here is called to awaken his dormant faith. In the language of Ephesians chapter 5:14, awake, O sleeper, and rise from the dead, so Christ might shine on you. What an amazing New Year's resolution that might be for your faith. If for years or decades you've been like Nehemiah, submerged, quiet, silent, and hidden, your faith real but contained to a Sunday morning safe environment, not lived out in your workplace, not lived out in your family, and not lived out amongst your friends. It interests me greatly that Nehemiah's name literally means, I am sorry, God. That's what his name means. I'm sorry, God. And I'm going to live differently from today. The other group of believers that we find at this point are represented by Nehemiah's brother, Hanani. Let me have a read of what it says. Let's pick it up in sentence 2. Have a look. Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. Its gates have been burned with fire. Now, Hanani and the others, they represent those who went with Ezra in those first couple of waves. Now, can you see what they've done? They've bravely and courageously gone to start rebuilding a land. They've had the Persian support withdrawn, and now they are desperately exposed, vulnerable and unprotected, to the point that those nations that were antagonistic and complained about Israel to the Persian government are now aggressive and attacking and demolishing Jerusalem. I wonder if you know what it's like to live a desperately exposed faith, where you feel really vulnerable and really unprotected as you live for Jesus in your workplace or your family or your home nation. On a very minor level, I remember when I very first became a Christian. I was a 19-year-old at university. I was particularly involved in the rugby team at university, and I met Jesus and I became a Christian. And I told some of my rugby mates that I'd done that, and they weren't enormously receptive to the idea. And I remember from that point onwards, in the rugby team, I was always the Christian. But then when I turned up at church for the very first time and didn't really know what was going on, because I'd never stepped into a church. In fact, the only spaces I'd ever been where there was a monologue from someone at the front to a big group was either lectures at university or comedy nights at the pub. And so my first few Sundays at church, just give yourself a brain break for a moment, first few Sundays at church, I'd be listening to the lecture and I'd put my hand up midway to ask a question. Which, by the way, I think is a brilliant idea to do in church. And I'd be ignored. And so after a couple of Sundays of this, I thought, it's not a lecture. It's a comedy night. What do you do at comedy nights? You heckle. So the next couple of Sundays, I just shout out, what a load of rubbish! The point is, from that point onwards, in church, I was never really a Christian. I was the rugby player. Does that make sense? And I don't know how many of you can associate with that. That sense of exposure, vulnerability. That in the workplace, people know you're a Christian and you're not quite on the inner circle. You're not always invited to the pub after work. Conversations dwindle away when you step into the break room and you wondered why you didn't actually get that promotion. Or perhaps in your family, you and your partner are not spiritually aligned. And so you know what it is to feel slightly awkward, even in your very own home. Exposed, vulnerable, unprotected. That's the other group we have here in Nehemiah. And I am struck by the fact that Hanani's name means I am seen. I am seen, or God sees you. So right at the beginning, I just wonder this morning, which one of those two groups, if it's helpful for you to think in this way, it explains or gives words to your aspirations this year, 2024, of living out your Christian faith, if you are a Christian this morning? Are you someone like Nehemiah who just needs to recognize you've been living something of a comfortable, silent, quiet, and hidden faith? And you need to say, Nehemiah, to God, I am sorry, God. Or are you a little bit more like Hanani, knowing what it's like to live in an unprotected and exposed environment in your home or your workplace, and you need to hear God say to you, Hanani, you are seen. I see you in that. I wonder which one you are. Let's get back into the text and carry on. What this all means for Nehemiah, this historical context, is what Nehemiah is called to, and we're going to explore it over the next couple of months here in the heavenly gathering. What he's called to is both to negotiate a new return to Judah and negotiate a reuniting of a divided people. And he needs to do that with limited resources, a resistant Persian government, with aggressive surrounding nations who are beginning to attack Israel, and with a cautious and suspicious people who are once bitten, twice shy, and wondering whether Nehemiah can do a better job than Ezra's errors. So I think there are two lessons I want to invite you to think about this morning that we learned from Nehemiah. Just two of them. And at the end of me speaking, to give you a heads up now, I'm going to invite you to talk to two or three people around you and wonder with them what God might be saying to you, if that's okay. Now, whenever I offer this, I always say there's an easy way to dodge it, which is you just look particularly pious. Okay? But I want to invite you to feel like you could listen to someone else's reflections and encourage them and share your own. Is that okay to do that together this morning? Brilliant. Lots of nods and a few like that. Yeah. Two lessons from Nehemiah. They're pretty simple, but I want to drive them home. The first lesson from Nehemiah as he faces this super, super difficult situation is our first response is always to pray. Our first response is always to pray. Have a look at sentence 4 in your Bible, would you? This is what it says. When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept. For some days I mourned and I fasted and I prayed before the God of heaven. Now, this is not just a quick arrow prayer that he shoots up into the air. He does that, interestingly, in chapter 2. This is much more than that. This is a sustained, overwhelming, soul-surrendering approach to prayer and fasting. Why do I know that? Because most of chapter 1 is dedicated to his prayer, isn't it? Emphasizing its depth and its breadth. Did you notice in sentence 4, it says, for many days he did this. For some days. In other translations, it says, I continued to do this. How many days? It's 4 months, friends. If you look at the dates given to us at the very beginning of chapter 1 and the dates given at the very beginning of chapter 2, it's 4 months of sustained prayer and fasting and pursuit of God and energy given to seeking God. He says in verse 6 in the prayer itself that he does this night and day. That is Hebrew language for both organized and spontaneous. It means both I structured my timetable around prayer and fasting. I organized my priorities, my daytime around prayer and fasting, but also night. Also the spontaneous, also the unplanned, also when I just woke up in the morning or I found myself with a spare half hour. I gave all of that as well to fast and to pray and to seek and to mourn. Maybe most revealing to me about what this prayer looks like is the little phrase, I sat down and wept. It means to collapse in emotional exhaustion. It means to be overwhelmed emotionally and physically to a point you cannot control your body anymore. To be so overcome, you break down. Ezra uses an almost identical phrase back in Ezra chapter 9, verse 3, just to check you're still awake. Why don't you turn your Bibles a couple of pages back? It literally is just one or two pages backwards. And Ezra chapter 9, verse 3, Ezra says something very similar. When I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. Do you get a sense of what that word means? He's so emotionally distraught and overcome, he's literally ripping the hair out of his face, tearing his hair from his head. Incredibly overwrought emotionally, spiritually, physically with a desire for God. This kind of approach to prayer is pretty uncomfortable, isn't it? I'm left with the question, when was the last time I prayed like this? I want to invite you to wonder about when was the last time you prayed like this? Jill is just showing off. Oh, it's not noticeable that it was you, Jill. No one's realized. That's a Jeremiah 33:3 moment. You know what it says in Jeremiah 33:3? God is calling. That's why she's. I'm left personally reflecting on Nehemiah's prayer life here. If you ask me, Alex, when was the last time you prayed like this? If you asked me that a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, I think I authentically could have evidenced a prayer life adjacent to what's described by Nehemiah here. But if I'm honest and vulnerable with you for a moment, over the last couple of years, I'm quite disappointed with myself as I reflect on Nehemiah's prayer life. When was the last time I so radically went after God that it dominated my schedule, it dominated my spontaneous time? It was day, it was night, it was 4 months long, and it meant there was times I was so emotionally and physically exhausted I couldn't even stand up off my chair. When was the last time you prayed like that? Have you ever? Is that potentially why you've never experienced God in the fullness you would hope? And when was the last time we as a church prayed like that? Corralled and cheered one another on and fanned into flame some collective approach to God that mirrored Nehemiah's approach here? I am deeply challenged as I've prepped this over the last couple of mornings and a little bit disappointed in myself. Before we move on to the second point, I think what I'd like to do, though, is to offer you three observations I've made about the outcome of this kind of prayer life in Nehemiah's life. The first is that this kind of prayer life means Nehemiah is able to handle authority really well. Some of us in the room today hold real authority in the workplace, or we're a trustee, or we steward things that impact other people's lives. Some of us hold people's lives actually in our hands. Some of us have the biggest responsibility, perhaps, of all, which is to be a parent. Huge authority we carry. How do we handle it well? See, what I notice here is Nehemiah describes himself as cupbearer to the king. Did you hear that in sentence 11? I'm cupbearer to the king. Now, that is a title equivalent to saying I'm the prime minister of the country. Cupbearer to the king, when the king was a functioning authority over the nation, not just a representative, but a functional authority. The cupbearer was his most entrusted and well thought of advisor. Historically in charge of checking his refreshments weren't poisoned, but became to be his closest advocate and ally and the implementer of his decisions. Nehemiah has incredible authority. But do you know what I noticed? Before he tells us he's cupbearer to the king, twice he tells us he's a servant. In verse 6 and verse 11. But before he talks about the authority he holds, he talks about being a servant in heart. His posture is to serve. If you want to handle the authority you have in life really well, not abusively, or not abdicate it, but hold it well, you need a prayer life like Nehemiah has here. The second thing I observe is this prayer life means he can handle fear productively and not be paralyzed by fear. Perhaps you fear a big decision. Perhaps you fear the reality of the life that you're living will be forever. The burden of singleness is something you never invited and fills you with fear. How do you handle that? Not by being paralyzed by it, but using it productively. If you look at chapter 2, sentence 2, do you notice right to the end of the sentence, he approaches the king and then he says, "I am very much afraid." Did you see that? Nehemiah is terrified of speaking to the king. What's the king going to think about this idea that Israel should continue their return? The king's already made a decision. Nehemiah, because of being cupbearer, was probably privy to that decision, informed that decision. Is he going back on his word? Is this Nehemiah beginning a political coup to try and take away the king's authority? What else is going on? Can the king even trust the food the king now is going to eat? Nehemiah's life is at risk as he engages in his conversation with the king. No wonder he's terrified, but his fear doesn't paralyze him. Do you see that? His fear isn't taken away, but he uses his fear productively. What are you doing with your fear? Place it into the context of this kind of prayer. And then the third observation I make about this prayer life, as it works out in Nehemiah's life, it enables him to handle complexity really wisely. He goes to the king and he broaches this topic. King, I'd like to go and continue the people going back and rebuilding. And the king asks all sorts of questions. Where are you going to get the resources from, Nehemiah? How are you going to negotiate peace with those antagonistic and aggressive nations? How are you going to work through the contract of resources that you'll need for this? How are you going to unite your own people who are already divided in their two different locations and living styles? How are you going to do this? And each time, we'll see in the next couple of weeks, Nehemiah has a really good response. A considered, strategic, wise response. Now, I think Nehemiah did more than just pray and fast for those 4 months to get to that point. He's done a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations, you know, the meetings before the meetings. But it is the prayer and fasting, which means that chapter 2, verse 8, Nehemiah says, "The good hand of the Lord was upon me. I had incredible wisdom in the complexity of that situation." What's your complexity? It could be a stage of life. 50% of us will spend between 10 and 20% of our life with the challenge of the menopause. How do you do that really wisely? As more and more people get older and older, with all the complexities of that, how do you handle your finances wisely? With the challenges about beginning of life questions, with folks circulating around you who are wondering whether they should carry a pregnancy to full term. How do you hold that wisely? In the complexities of the questions of life, it comes out of a prayer life like Nehemiah's. Let me pause and allow us to get our wits around us for a moment, if I may, as you ponder and chew on this. Remember Helen and her picture right at the start. Jesus walking off the Bible, seeing myself, seeing my life, seeing Jesus through the Bible, God's word doing God's work. What is he starting to say to you this morning? Whether you've been to church for all of your life, and this is the 50,000th sermon you've heard, and it's somewhere near the bottom end of the list of quality, yeah? Or whether it's the very first time you've heard would you call me a stand-up comedic or a lecture? I'm not sure where you put me on that scale. What is Jesus saying to you this morning? Is it something about your hidden faith like Nehemiah and a need to say a sorry? Is it something about your exposed faith and needing Jesus to hear Jesus say to you, you are seen? Is it something about your prayer life or our prayer life? Is it something about how you handle authority well or how you handle complexity well or how you handle fear well? What is it for you? Name it in your head and your heart right now. Right, I said there was two things, wasn't I? The second one is a little bit quicker. And what we learn from Nehemiah is that our ultimate delight is always Jesus' fame. That's the second thing we learn, that our ultimate delight is always Jesus' fame. We're going to have a look at the prayer in more detail in the weeks ahead, but would you look with me at how the prayer finishes in verse 11? Would you just look down there? It says, "Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of the king." Do you see the little phrase right in the middle? Who delight in revering your name. Do you see that phrase? He's saying, actually, my greatest delight, my biggest joy, the thing that fills me with deepest satisfaction is actually God's name being honored. That if I can live my life in such a way that God's name is given respect and honor and worship and praise, I will find deep joy in my heart, delight in revering God's name. Now, I want to be super clear. We live in a point in history, friends, where we know God's name. God's name is Jesus. He's not kept it hidden. He's not disguised himself. He's not been silent. He said, "Here I am." I wonder if I can illustrate it like this as we come into land with a story and then a last question. So give yourselves a brain break and just re-engage for a second. Have you ever played hide and seek with a toddler? I think I've told some of you this story before, haven't I? I love playing hide and seek with a toddler because they just cannot hide. Have you noticed this? Like, you cover your eyes and you say, "I'm going to count to 10, and then you need to go high. You go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then "Ready or not, here I am." And before you finish, what do they? "Here I am, Daddy, find me." And they kind of leap out like that. Have you had that experience? Yeah. I remember doing one of our boys once, and I heard him say, "Here I am, Daddy." And his head popped out the washing machine that he'd climbed in. But sometimes we think God is more like a sniper hidden present but invisible. There, but so silent and quiet, we never see him. But God is not like that. God is like a toddler playing hide and seek. And in Jesus, he's leapt out and said, "Here I am! Here I am! Find me!" That's what God does in Jesus. It's incredible, isn't it? Remark like he did with Helen, a 1,000-watt light bulb. "Helen, here I am! My name is Jesus!" And Nehemiah says, "I delight in revering your name. I find joy, satisfaction, completeness, fullness when your name is revered." Now that shouldn't surprise us. We're designed to be like that. Human beings find their greatest joy in another's glory. Think of the art critic effervescent about the latest Banksy installment. The art critic's joy is at its highest when they talk about how brilliant Banksy is. Yes? Or think about a parent annoying you ceaselessly with their child's brilliance that you cannot see yourself. But that parent's joy is effervescent, isn't it? When they can broadcast the wonder of their child. Yes, you know that? "I've just had a baby, they're in the pram, do you want to have a look? Oh, aren't they beautiful?" "Well, I'm not sure, but you could..." Or the best man, the good best man, sitting exhausted in the shadows at the end of the day, delighting that the applause is for his groom and bride. The best man's joy is highest when the bride and groom are most honored and delighted in, isn't it? This is how human beings are made. In fact, that last illustration is straight from John the Baptist in John 3. But John the Baptist said, "I must become less so he might become more, and then my joy is complete." So my last question for you is, in your life today, what will make Jesus most famous? What will make Jesus most valued? What would make Jesus most treasured? Because whatever the answer is to that question will bring you most joy. Delight is found when you revere God's name. And his name is Jesus. No one else. Jesus. So what is God saying to you? Is it something about your hidden faith and saying sorry? Is it something about your exposed faith and knowing you are seen? Is it something about your prayer life, your handling of authority, your handling of fear, your handling of complexity? Or is it something about delighting to revere God's name, making him famous in your life? You've got 3 or 4 minutes to listen to someone else and openly share your reflections. Off you go, 3 or 4 minutes, and then I'm going to pray for us. Find someone to chat to. and learn together, trusting you did actually talk and the sermon, not something else. I'm just going to take the risk and invite you to do one last exercise, because it's so important we don't just gather information on a Sunday morning. Let's be honest, for many of us this might be our main or perhaps only engagement with the Bible in the week, as much as we have good intentions to be better than that. So it's super important that we work hard with one another to say, actually, what am I learning to put into practice? Not just information, but transformation is what we're looking for, without putting too grand a word on it. So I'd like to do one other little exercise with you, if I may, which is just take a minute. I'm going to ask you to put your hand up once. I'm going to give you three options, but you can only put your hand up for one of them. All right? I'm going to be strict. Someone's bouncing. I want two. You can only have one. All right? And I want you just to, basically we've talked about three things from Nehemiah, so I want you to identify with a hand up which one of the three feels most significant for you personally. So first category, let me just tell you the categories. First one, was it something about the interplay between Nehemiah's name and Hanani's name, like the hidden faith and the exposed faith, the needing to say to God, I'm sorry, or the needing to hear God say to you, I'm seen? Like, were you in that category? That's category one. Was that the main thing? Category two is that whole prayer piece. Is that where you felt God was particularly talking to you? That idea of prayer, your prayer, our prayer, whatever it might be. And number three is just that last bit, which we didn't spend as much time as I anticipated. I didn't manage the time well enough to go as deep as I would have liked. But that whole idea that our delight is most found when we bring Jesus glory. Like our joy and his glory are intrinsically connected. What does it mean to be Jesus' best man and give up all that you are so he is made famous and find your joy complete in that? They're the three categories. So exposed or hidden, the prayer piece, or the delight to revere his name. So could you just pick one mentally? And then just as a little sign, it's a hand up. No one's like recording it. I'm not counting or anything like that. I'm not going to tomorrow say, oh, well, 17 people became Christians with a hand up yesterday. It's none of that business. This is about your own personal kind of landing on it. So who's more in that hidden faith, exposed faith, like that space of wanting to say either sorry to God or hear him say, cool, brilliant, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Ironically, if you're hidden faith, I've just exposed you, haven't I? But who's more in that prayer space, something about prayer? Right, so loads of folk there. I was super challenged. I would be in that middle category if I was sitting listening. Thank you. And who's more in that kind of delight to revere his name, that idea that are so a bunch of you there as well. Super interesting for me. Thank you very much. I'm going to invite us to stand, sing Amazing Grace, and then that'll help Barbara take us into a communion with the kids back in before we finish in